You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
The JSE has closed its doors for another day, so it's time for the 5 o'clock shadow. And as always on a Thursday, it's the double-header dream team of David Shapiro from Sesame Securities and Nick Kunzer from Sunland Private Wealth. And David, we start with you. There's going to be a couple of trillion pumped into the US market maybe in the next few hours. And it's obviously a good thing. I mean, when you divide it by how many tens of millions of people there are in the US, it's not going to be much. But goodness me, if you get a check for 2,000 and you're unemployed and you haven't been able to buy your kids' shoes or something for the last 6 months, this is a really, really welcome injection.
No, of course, and it's not too soon. I think that signs are there of things starting to slow down. They can't afford that. You know, the Fed, the government, certainly Biden's administration, have to keep the momentum going. And, you know, Lindsay, I think, like everybody, one wants to know, well, when is this going to end? And I think the only time it'll end is when they manage to distribute the vaccines and people get confidence back and they take down lockdown. You know, people start not traveling again, but certainly going out and the service industry pick up and the economy picks up, and not too soon. So I don't know, you know, the extent of this package. You said 2 trillion. It might be over time that they inject it, but I don't think they're the only country that are going to do this. I think Europe is still in a similar area, even South Africa.
Yes.
We've got no money. We haven't got it, but I think we're going to have to go to the printing presses and kind of just, you know, print more rand or do something, because I think this is also an economy that's going to need some of that motherly love that you were talking about.
You know, so, yes.
Mothering, yeah.
Nick,
so it's no, all I'm saying is that they do not have any choice. They can't let this fall back because, you know, once it falls back, Lindsay, we go into this loop, this downward loop, which eventually ends up in a recession, depression.
Nick comes in now and starts talking about the effect of the inflationary effect. Now, David's going to refute this argument that have.
We're a good bunch of round table intelligent people.
We're at cross purposes here, but it will be inflationary consequences. And I mean, I know whole efficient thing that we've spoken about before, but when you see the corn futures and the milk futures and the iron ore price and the oil price, price has nearly tripled in the last few months. So there is something bubbling under. So over to you, Nick. There you go.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is. I mean, look, the concern, I don't know. The jury's out on what the best solution is, because the world can't handle another sort of recession, and it probably can't handle another sort of collapse like we saw in 08 with the financial crisis. So the next best option is to have a concerted effort by central banks around the world to effectively keep the patient alive. The problem you've got, though, at some point, going to have to exit. And I don't think it's going to be that easy to exit. And if I compare it to the amount of money that America is spending, I mean, government debt in the U.S., I mean, that's increased by more than, I think, $4 or $5 trillion, the number was this year. I mean, I'm losing track of these numbers. Sorry, last year, 2020.
Yes.
I mean, that's over, I think, 13, or I saw the headline, $13,000 per person. I mean, that's a world record.
Yeah.
But they're not the only Western government to go on a spending spree, but I mean, they've gone on the biggest. But I mean, they're using a playbook that, I mean, China followed after 2008, right? When they followed this massive increase in fiscal spending. But I think the difference was in China, they went and you saw the pictures, you know, doing the rounds. They funded massive infrastructure projects, airports, railways, ports, you name it. They have extraordinary pictures of these, you know, airports that are watering the scale of them, etc. But look at what the U.S. is doing with their debt in 2020. No new roads, no airports, no railways, nothing. They're basically spending trillions of dollars, and another $2 trillion coming tonight probably, to send checks for people to sit home and watch Netflix. So in the end, that's a really unproductive debt. So I don't know. The hope is they put it back into the market in some shape or form. There's a massive pent-up demand. The guy, I don't know, they spend on restaurants, they buy the car they wanted, maybe they upgrade their house, etc. That's the hope. But it's a very different playbook to what we've seen in the past with this sort of spending. So I don't know. It's a bit of a, I guess it's a bit of an uncharted water. It's a project that we haven't seen before. But I personally, if I look at what what's happening with the commodity markets and the sort of the stuff on the ground floor, this certainly is implying in the rising sort of yield curve, it's implying that you cannot spend this amount of money, incorporate this much debt in the biggest economy in the world. At some point, inflation is going to come hit them in the face and hit them very hard.
But we've been saying it for so many years now. And I don't know, David, what you think, but if you own the means of production, and when I talk about the means of production now, it's not a communist term I've just used. Mm. You own the means of production of money. And that's what the United States does. It just produces money. It buys it from its own central bank and its treasury and everything. And it just gets circulated in the system. And inflation has been under control for, well, I don't know, actually maybe even a couple of decades. I can't remember the last time it was out of control.
I think what's happened is it's a confidence factor. The reason that rates are zero is that they want to encourage people to borrow and to go out and spend. But that hasn't really happened. And one of the reasons it doesn't happen is because people feel insecure. They're also worried about their jobs, so they are saving. So I think Nick touched on the fact that people are they're sitting at home, they're getting the checks, but I don't think they're spending it. And I think that's what they do want to unleash. When that does get unleashed, then I think you are right. You will see demand push inflation, because if that wall comes, we would love it to go into actual business spending. In other words, developing businesses, buying more machinery, in infrastructure, you know, building more factories, building roads, which was more something that's done by governments rather than private enterprise. But I think all of that didn't come. It didn't come over 10 years, and it hasn't come now. So I think everybody's trying to find how to unlock the confidence and to get people to borrow at zero. You know, you would think, if people are saying to you, here, you know, you don't have to pay interest. Here's money. Yes. If you're so scared that you're not going to be able to pay it back, that you don't do it. So you do take it and go, sorry.
Yeah, sorry, David makes a very good point. But I think the other thing we haven't touched on along on this conversation is that with the yield curve rising, with the cost of money rising, the big decision, the big quandary I've got is, what does the Federal Reserve do? I mean, do they let those bond yields rise or not? You've seen the last few days, there's been talk of a yield curve control, you know, YCC, and all these wonderful little analogies that come out. And that is the one concern, because they can't lose control of the curve. They can't be behind it. Mm-hmm. So if the Fed decide they want to let them normalize to, say, pre-COVID levels, just for argument's sake, we go back to pre-COVID and the world goes back to normal and people start spending and all the rest of it. But in the meantime, they've literally printed $4 trillion of debt last year. They're going to smack another $2 odd trillion in the next couple of weeks. That's $6 trillion of debt. If they do that and bond yields rise, let's say they rise, I don't know, 50 basis points. They go from 1.1 to 1.6, right? That 50% basis point rise that the Fed has to service, right? They have to service that debt. They have to pay the debt to their – they have to service that debt, okay? If that's just that 50 pip rise – that's like the equivalent to the annual budget of, I don't know, the U.S. Navy, for example. You know, another 30 pips of the U.S. Marines and so on. So they are borrowing so much money, they're going to have to pay that interest. I don't know if they can afford to let that interest rate go up. They can't fund – how do they fund that debt? No one's even talking about this yet, but it's coming. And I don't know if that's why – when David, you made the bet with Lindsay on Tuesday that they can never let rates go up. You might be right.
Yeah.
They can never let rates go up because they can't afford to pay the interest.
No, they can't.
They can't.
What?
They don't have the money.
I can't afford to pay the debt either. But anyway, go on.
The counter-argument was the one that Trump used when he pulled down interest tax rates. You know, he said what happens is that businesses are going to flourish because they're paying less tax, therefore they're going to make more profits, and they'll build on those profits, and tax revenue will increase, and we'll be able to pay down debt and so on. So I think the opposite, the one area we don't talk about is, well, what happens when we get out of this pandemic and we start growing at a pace which we can't keep control of? In other words, we make up all that lost time and we start to generate lots of profit and so on. And how's that going to help us actually pay back, you know, the $4 trillion or however much money we've generated? So there is that chance as well. There is that argument as well that, okay, you know, when we start growing as well, we're going to get huge, huge inflows, which are going to help us kind of offset some of the negative effects that we've been talking about. I'm saying that's the theory. We don't know. We don't know how.
Well, that's what I said. This is almost like this project. We don't know how it's going to pan out. We don't. None of us do.
Can I bring this back to the United Kingdom? Because I was speaking to a chap the other day, very clever chap at an asset management company in London. And he said to me, Lindsay, we've been going through the numbers and the forecasts of the Bank of England for growth and all sorts of other indicators for 2021. And I could hear him shaking his head because he said they're all so, so way off from what we think. We've got the situation now where the people with money are not going out. They're not going out for a decent meal once a week. They're not traveling. They're sitting at home, maybe buying a little bit of this and that via Amazon or whatever company. It says the money that's coming into the system that's been provided by government is being spent by the lower income people in order to survive. Now, he said the economy is grinding to a halt. And he says, if you think that the UK economy is recovering according to these BOE numbers, then you're absolutely wrong. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know if he's right, but he's certainly a very clever chap. And I've always respected his views over the years. But maybe the same thing might happen in the United States. I don't know. As Nick would say, a Petri dish. We don't know what's going to happen. What's going to grow in that dish over the next year? But 2021 is not going to be easy. That's for sure.
We've had 10 years of this. You know, we still haven't overcome the 08-09. Yeah, what's 08-09? You're right, 12 years of it. We haven't overcome that issue yet. We were just starting to show some kind of form when the virus hit us. Mm. So, you know, we've been living in the most incredibly difficult times. I mean, the market.
A good part of a decade.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, David's exactly right. We there's such a fast moving world right now with everything on Twitter and the internet and this and that. You know, we forget that for the last, I guess, 10, 11 years since the 08 financial crisis. I mean, David's right. We haven't actually come out of that yet. Rates are still at zero around the world. Rates are still at negative. We've got $17 trillion of negative yielding bonds. We tried the negative rate experiments around the world to counter the effect from the financial crisis in 08. You know, and it's 2021 and we still got the hangover from then. And then we got hit with the pandemic in April this year.
I'm going to digress for a bit, but it supports my argument. Because what we're talking about is the kind of market that we've been going through. And I've been doing, just to, you know, when I've been looking at the JSE, I just say, we haven't been able to provide people with a real return in South Africa for I don't know how long. I'm talking a real return. I don't know, in the world, you know, anybody who saved and used to save under convention, you know, put the 60-40, put 40% in bonds and you'll get a decent yield. And I'm not talking about the capital gains, because that was never part of the formula. The formula was that the capital would remain stable and you would get a yield, you'd get a return on your investment. You know, the old post office book or something that would give you a bit of money and from which you would pay a slight bit of tax, but it would enable you to live in. We haven't had that for 10 years. We haven't had it for yep. you know, and it's absolutely destroyed the savings industry. I'm not saying the financial planners.
The clever bankers around the world kind of screwed that up too. The central bankers came out and they said, let's try this new experiment. It's called negative rates.
Yeah.
We're gonna cut rates to minus. Mm-hmm. There's no chapter in your economics book for that. It's negative yielding bonds. It doesn't exist. They try to rewrite it. And the idea was, if we force everyone, we'll charge people to keep money in the bank. We'll charge them. So we're basically going to put negative rates. We're going to force you to go out and spend money and the economy is going to basically turn. Yeah. But what actually happened, and we've seen it around in Europe, there's actually been a huge pushback. Places like Scandinavia, they're the first ones to exit this negative experiment. They said the reverse happened. people got so petrified, like David said, they got so nervous, they didn't want to spend money. They actually hoarded it. They didn't spend. They had the complete opposite effect.
Yes, but you know what? You can. It's like comparing. It's like saying, well, if you do this in Japan, then we can do it in America, and everything will be the same. The Scandinavians, the Japanese, are very different from the British and the Americans.
No, they are, but
people are
but
different.
My point being that. And Dave, just to allude to what David was saying, is that what had actually happened was it had a negative effect and it punished savers. People, that whole model of having 60% equities, 40% bonds, rip that rule book, throw it out, it'll never be the same again. It can never be the same. The central bank has introduced negative rates, negative yielding bonds. They introduced quantitative easing, yield curve control, all the rest of it. So that whole model now does not work. That playbook doesn't work. And in the meantime, the savers around the world got absolutely pumped. We almost had to reinvent investing.
Totally.
You were buying bonds for asset price appreciation, and you were buying equities for a yield. That is inversely proportional to everything we've learned for 50 years of investing.
All I can say is that I'm going to win this bet. Interest rates will go up in the United States this year. David Shapiro will be buying me a very nice ticket on KLM to go to Johannesburg and also buy me a lovely meal at Melrose Arch. And that... That is the end of it. And by the way, David Shapiro, in case you disappear, Nick Kunzer has written this down, this bit that we had.
No, it's fine.
Okay.
It's fine.
Let's have a look at the JSE Securities Exchange, Stock Exchange News Service today. Richard Brasher is stepping down as CEO of Pick and Pay, a chap called Peter Boone. Now, I have this something in my head, it's called a CEOmeter, Chief Executive Ometer. And I think he's very good at what he's done. He's been, he's fallen back a little bit, I suppose, or rather the company has, when it comes to market share compared to ShopRite. He hasn't done as badly as Woolies, but so he's good. But I always felt very uncomfortable with him somehow. But anyway, he's gone and I wish him well. And then Remgro, the only other thing I can see of any interest, is results of a bid in the open market to create liquidity for RCL Foods shareholders, which is quite right because you can't trade the blasted thing, David.
So they want to buy it back. What I wanted to do is I looked at Richard Brasher and I read the report that came out from Gareth Ackerman, and it came out from all the different, their PR people putting out the quotes which they write for them. You know, Gareth said this, Richard said that, and how wonderful it was. So I went and I said, okay, 8 years, how's Pick and Pay done?
Here we go.
In other words, if you invested in Pick and Pay 8 years ago, well, you're up 12.5%.
In 8 years.
In 8 years. So, listen, he did pretty well. I mean, I'm not criticizing him because that's a great performance. The one that ran away was Spar, which is up 50%. So, I mean, that's up around about – that's the only one where you got anywhere close to a decent return, and it's not even that a decent return. ShopRite in 8 years is down 35%. Woolies down 41%. And Massmart down 80%. I mean, these retailers have been absolutely pulverized. And I'm saying, okay, you know, why have we got a retail analyst? You know what?
The Spar story is an interesting one because Graham O'Connor, based in Durban, he is one of the – there's a whole little nest of CEOs that I like speaking to. I always look forward to speaking to Graham O'Connor at Spar. He's obviously got an Irish background and he's always very personal, and you can hear he's got a twinkle in his eye. But, he's good. And one of the reasons that Spar, I think, has done well, David, in the last 6 or 7 months is because – they're the round-the-corner shop. In other words, when people couldn't travel, when you were in lockdown, you couldn't get in the car and go to a big Pick and Pay or wherever it was. So people would just go, as I say, round the corner to the Spar. And that, when I made that point to him the last time I spoke to him, he said, it's exactly right. We have benefited perversely from the lockdown situation in South Africa. So, it's interesting. The different personalities. Nick, are you a retailer?
I actually do like a few of them, and I've just signed up to, I've mentioned a few times in your show, I've just signed up to that that 6D Checkers app.
Oh yeah.
I did try the home after the sort of second wave here in South Africa, Lindsay. It's been quite bad, and people have taken it quite seriously. A lot of people actually have stayed at home, and so we decided to try home delivery. and trialled the Woolies one, and the first available date for delivery was like 3 weeks ahead, between like 2 and 3 in the morning. So we gave that a miss, and then we went on the Checkers app, and 60 Minutes delivered to our front door, and us, those big brown paper bags you see like in the movies. Dropped in our front door within 60 minutes. They were absolutely brilliant. So I'm sort of a little bit of a Checkers convert now. So, yeah, I have been trying it out.
Hmm. Have a look at a company called... I can't fault
the service, you know, of retailers, and I can't fault the quality of them. I'm talking about it as an investment. And, you know, when we look at the returns, I mean, yes, it's indicative of what's happened in South Africa. I'm not going to argue that point. It's, you know, we've gone through a really horrid time. And it's only when you look at the history and you say, oh, I know every day we've got our analysts going through the results and going on and looking at their models. I'm saying, this has been a disaster. If you've been in there for 8 years, it was far better either to have your money under the mattress or certainly even if you had those old post office books or whatever. In fact, while I'm doing this, I'm not great at multitasking, but I'm trying to get the, you know, what the yield is over 8 years if you were in Pick and Pay. But I am ignoring any dividends.
Do you know what? You know what? It's almost like they had this sort of the glory days where a decade or so ago, you know, the Whitey Masons of the world, yeah, and the Christo Vises when he was in his prime, and those. I mean, they were demanding sort of. They were demanding sort of valuations of 30. I think ShopRite used to be on like 30 times earnings.
Yeah.
But they justified them because they came out of them. And since sort of everything hit a halt and slowed down, you know, our retailers are cheap. But now the problem I've got a problem now with the fact that, yes, they're cheap, but there's very little growth in the areas they operate, especially in the South African and Sub-Saharan Africa space. And then the other knock-on effect is, you know, if I look at once again, you know, we've mentioned the corn prices and white maize is at 3,800 rand a ton and so on. If that's almost, they've almost doubled some of these soft commodities. How do you pass on that sort of increase? You can't double the price of bread. There'll be riots on the streets. Mm. So I don't know where the margin, in fact, I think their margins are going to be squeezed. So I think they're in for a little bit of a tough period.
It's interesting.
I mean, David mentioned the fact that Pick and Pay did 8%, you know, and didn't even grow. But I mean, I think they're in for even a harder time going forward.
The average rate.
Just before you go on, I just want to, David, and you collate your statistics now. I don't know if any of you have heard of a company called Ocado. Now, if you walk around the streets of London at 11 o'clock at night, or at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you'll find a van that says Ocado on the side. And I didn't know what this was. And I asked my friend, I said, what is this? And Ocado Group is a publicly traded company that provides solutions for online groceries to retailers across the globe. So it aggregates everybody. So you go into the Ocado website and you say, right, I want this from Pick and Pay. I want this from ShopRite, as a South African-based example. But you get all different prices. So you say, well, it's cheaper at Marks and Spencer's than it is at Morrison's or Sainsbury's in London. Mm-hmm. And you put your basket together over a period of days and they deliver it. But you see these vans running around at 11, 11.30 at night, Nick, exactly the same thing that you were saying. Mm-hmm. And this has been listed since 2010. It was way ahead of its time. It's been delivering for, what is that, 11 years now. It's an incredible service. It's very good. David, anyway, over to you on your numbers.
Nice. So here you are. So your per annum yield on Pick and Pay over 8 years has been 1.5% per annum. Exclude the dividend. So I don't know what the dividend, if they did pay a dividend, you might get it up to 3 or 4% or something. But your capital gain, and on Spar, it's been 5.2%. Lindsay, I took out something yesterday for you.
Thank you.
And you're going to kill me.
Oh, God.
Or no, not kill me. I mean, you're entitled to kill me. So I was working out over 5 years what the yield on the JSE has been.
Yes.
Over five, and it's 3.5%.
Yeah.
And then this is in rands, and then I took out gold, and I said, well, if you held Kruger Rand over the last 5 years, what's your yield been per annum? It's 11%.
Oh, really?
So 11 versus 3, you know, and I always attack. This is gold. Nick, this is not, you know, this is just 1 ounce of gold. This, and I was absolutely horrified. You know, because I mean, if there's anybody been trashing gold, it's been me. And it's
isn't it also a lot to do with the rand as well?
Yeah. Oh yeah, no, listen, it's got to do with lots of things. But I'm saying it doesn't matter. All those people, I said, you know, why are you holding Kruger rands? Go buy this or go buy that. In the meantime, I mean, it over 5 year period, especially with the last year, you know, during which it had a bit of a kick up. I don't know the dollar comparisons. I don't think the dollar comparison. I don't think holding gold versus the S&P.
No.
You know, I think the S&P would have killed it. But I mean, in Rand, in our market, it was a remarkable statistic. And I said, okay, you know, don't advertise that too much.
David Shapiro, the man with no gold in any of his portfolios. The dollar rand, let's talk about the markets now. The dollar rand is nice and strong, or the rand is. It's 15.15. The British pound against the rand is 20.69. The euro rand is 18.36. The euro dollar is 120.120, which is about a 0.7% move to the upside for the dollar, to the downside for the euro. British pound 136.60. The gold price? The aforementioned gold price, 1843, which is just up very, very slightly. Platinum is 1116, which is probably about a percent higher, I think. Palladium is where, please, Nick Kunzer?
Quarter percent higher, 2,390.
Okay, and the crude oil price is flat, the West Texas anyway. It's $52.88 per barrel. Brent crude oil is down 0.6% to $55.71. Nick, what is Bitcoin, please?
It was actually had quite a big bounce back. Hold on a second.
While you're doing that, the US 10-year is 110 and a half, but so down from 118 earlier in the week, but still bubbling under
so
there.
So Bitcoin is up 7%, $2,500, $39,824.
Look at that thing. What was it earlier in the year? 4,000 or 5,000, I think it was, something like that.
Okay.
It was at the height of the pandemic, or the low of the pandemic in March, 4,500.
It started this year. It started this year at where are we now? At $21,000. So it's doubled so far.
Yeah, but I mean 2020 in March, I think it went down to something like 5,000. Or am I talking rubbish?
Yeah, 16th of March, I went down into the fives.
Okay.
4,926, if you want to be exact.
Okay, yeah, I do want to be exact. S&P, NASDAQ and Dow Jones live, please, Nick.
Okay, S&P is up just 10 points, 3,850, 3,815. The Dow Jones, that is at, so let me give you the S, so, and the NASDAQ is sitting exactly 13,005, and the Dow Jones is 31,102.
Jolly good. Okay, I think what we should do is to go to the top five movers, and David, you can come in here, because I think because of what happened regarding banning Chinese companies from certain activities in the United States of America and on their securities exchanges, Tencent and a few others went up quite sharply this morning. So I've got Naspers up 4.2%, Hammerson, the property company, up 3.9%, MediClinic up 3.6%, and Prosus, the sister or brother of Naspers, up 3.5%. On the downside, Telkom down 5 1/3, Harmony down 4 1/3, and Discovery, the only one of note outside of some smaller companies, 3 3/4% weaker. Any of those ones in your portfolios, David?
The weak ones.
Weak or strong.
The process and Naspers, yes. Yeah. I've got both of those. I haven't got medical. I haven't got much in a local portfolio. But Lindsay, you missed one thing there, which
yes.
I'm going to ask Nick to talk about.
Oh, good.
This company called Montauk.
Yes, what is that? I don't even know what it is.
It's up 20% today.
20.03%.
It was 40 rand a few months ago, if you got in on it.
Oh, this is a ethane. What do they do? It came out of HCI at one stage, and I don't know where it is.
I should be asking you, David. It's all your boys at the shul. You should know the answer to this one.
Are the Yiddish boys the ones that run it? I don't know.
What does it do?
gas exploration. It's more of a holding company.
Okay.
But they specialize in gas exploration in North America and the like.
And what do you? But when I saw it, I thought it was Monta UK, but it's not. It's Montauk, right? Which sounds like almost like a Native American word or something like that.
There's a whole story behind this because they actually are delisting next week. So they're not delisting. Correct me if I'm wrong. No, they're not delisting. They are changing and getting a primary listing on the NASDAQ next week, Friday.
Wow.
And going to maintain a secondary listing on the JSE.
Why?
But there's a lot of small print with how the new listing is going to be released as a dividend. We haven't enough time on the show to talk about
it. Is this a process listing?
It makes process look simple. But anyway, the story itself is actually quite interesting about the company, and they've done very well. But it's only if you look at the volume the last week, it's really shot up. I think a lot of people it gets very complicated when you start looking at the tax implications as a listing, because you're basically going to have to pay withholding tax. So we had a lot of clients that decided to just sell rather than to try to figure out the taxes. Yeah. And they can always buy back into it on the other side.
The other one is this Cartrack as well, because I was looking at this also, Lindsay. This is, I think there's a little bit of confusion, and people have to be very careful because they're offering 42 Rand, the shares are at 50, and they're saying to you, listen, this is going to be a new company. So you're going to get cash. We're going to give you cash, but that cash you can put into a vehicle. And when we list on NASDAQ, we'll buy you back the shares, but it's going to be a whole new purchase. They are going to have a secondary listing. But the problem is that I worked out, I said, okay, what happened to a person who bought the shares a year ago? You're going to pay capital gains tax because the shares a year ago
You sell it. Is that the reason why? Yeah. When you sell and go into the new vehicle, the first sale attracts capital gains. Is that what you're saying?
No. When they pay you the 42 Rand.
Oh, I see. Right.
You're going to pay capital gains then. So even though they might put the cash that they would have offered you into that vehicle, but when the tax man comes to you and says, "Well, what do? You said, "Well, I sold these." He says, "Well, thank you very much. I want XYZ capital gains tax." So you've got to find more cash, to pay your capital gains.
Yeah, David's touching on a very good point, and hopefully people are listening to the show who are looking at a few of these shares we're talking about, because you really need – it's one of the few countries I've ever had to work and trade where I spend more time trying to figure out the tax than I do on investment decisions. South Africa's investments – all so complicated when it comes to dividend tax, withholding tax, corporate taxes. I promise you, it is more complicated than I ever dealt with before. And you've really got to get advice before you decide to, you look at something like a Cartrack, you look at a good investment office, Montauk, which is just recent, and you like the story of listing on the NASDAQ, etc. Please get advice, because it all comes with a lot of other stuff like capital gains, withholding tax, if it's a PTY, if it's a private individuals, if it's you got to fill out your form, a WC form, whatever it's called with the SEC in America. It gets very complicated. And when you think you made money, sometimes in the small print, by the time you finish figuring it out, you actually haven't. So please, please, please get advice before you think it's a no-brainer.
Very good.
That's my advice for the show
today. Very good advice. And following up from the advice, give us the JSE's closing indices, please.
Well, I think we briefly today, gents, we briefly touched a new all-time high on the all shares, 63. I can't believe we actually got there and we didn't break it. Oh, we did. 64,056 intraday today was a new all-time high on the all shares.
Mazel tov. Well done.
Yes, but we finished up a little bit off the highs, but still 63,884. We closed in the all share up 0.65%. Same goes to the top 40, new intraday high today, 0.68% firmer, 58,735. And of course, with all the shenanigans going on, takeovers and all that sort of stuff, utilities were the biggest movers. So they're a bit skewed there. That index was up 20%, but that is a little bit skewed because of that. But technology shares led by the likes of Prosus and Nusp, as we mentioned.
Yeah.
That index up 3%. Industrials up 1%. Day today as well, with Aspen, that was up 0.93%. Energy 0.68%. The laggers today, financials, despite what I would think was a firmer rand, they were very weak today, the financials. That index down 0.65%, and consumer cyclicals down 0.26%. And value traded today, Second day in a row, we've had a decent volume, 21.37 billion value traded.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know if it's people coming back or just a general feeling of goodwill for the new year. I don't know. But anyway, we'll take it. 20 billion plus. Very good indeed. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time this evening, as always. Nick Kunzer is from Sunland Private Wealth. David Shapiro is from Sasfin Securities. And that was the 5 o'clock shadow. The views and opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of Lindsay Williams and various contributors and do not reflect the policy, position, or opinion of any other agency, organization, employer, or company associated with strictlybusinesspodcast.com. Assumptions made on the analyses are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the speaker or the author. And since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to change, revision, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity.